Welcome to episode 39 of the Policy Options Podcast. I'm Alex Shadid, Outreach Assistant at the IRPP. Often lost in the day-to-day discussions of how we trade is the deep discussion of why we trade. Trade creates economic opportunities and makes goods more accessible, all for the underlying goal of improving the lives of consumers. But as we continue to better understand the workings and effects of the global trading system, a number of major contradictions between the how and why sides of trade have become evident. One of the most glaring contradictions is the fact that a system which works to improve our lives is rife with barriers which make it relatively difficult for half the world's population to share in the benefits it produces. In a chapter she authored for the IRPP's new trade volume, Arantxa Gonzalez, the executive director of the International Trade Center in Geneva, examined the major structural factors keeping women entrepreneurs from participating in global trade on equal terms with men. I caught up with her on Skype to learn more about the issue and to find out what world leaders can do to address it. Welcome to the podcast, Arantxa.
Thank you so much for this opportunity.
So how would you evaluate entrepreneurship and labor force participation, for that matter, among women in developing countries?
Let's say that I would say there is a big room for improvement. There is lots of space to grow it. There is lots of space to move from informal to formal. There is lots of space to move from domestic market to international. There is lots of space to export. There is lots of space to participate more in government procurement. Let me give you some figures. There is in the world 1 billion women that are disconnected from markets. There is in the world, when we look at exporters, in surveys that we have done over 20 countries around the world, only 1 in 5 exporting companies would be owned by women. Less than 1% of the 15 trillion spent by governments on public procurement is served by women-owned enterprises. So all of this seems to indicate that as far as women entrepreneurs in developing countries, as well as in developed countries, by the way, there is a loss of room for improvement, a lot of room to grow, which gives us an indication where to grow.
And in your chapter, you highlighted a number of major structural factors that are keeping women from participating more effectively in SME entrepreneurship. Would you mind outlining a few of those structural factors?
So structural factor number one is laws. Over 90% of countries in this world still have one, if not more, laws that discriminate women's participation in the economy compared to men. Structural obstacle number two is procedures. Even in places where the law is the same, the manner in which the law is applied is different. For example, in surveys of over 30 countries that we have conducted, we've realized that when it's a woman entrepreneur that goes through customs, the possibility that she's going to be asked for a bribe is higher than if it is a man that goes through customs. Structural obstacle number three is access to finance. And it's linked to laws in that in many countries, women cannot own assets. And if they don't own assets, it's going to be very difficult to have access to credit beyond microcredit. So we know that there is over $200 billion US dollars in financial gap vis-a-vis women in business, which is a structural impediment number three. Structural impediment number four is absence of networks. Very often, women in business don't have the necessary networks, alliances that men in business have. And the fifth and very important one is culture, norms, traditions. It's what keeps women in unpaid jobs, very often having to do with the care economy, taking care of the family, for example. Disproportionate amount of time spent by women in unpaid work that limits the time available for women to devote to paid, remunerated work, which is why in many instances you find many women in the informal sector. So all of this is the list of structural obstacles that we need to fix.
Anyway, how would you evaluate the international community's efforts and strategies to try to counteract these structural factors and improve women's participation in the labor force and in entrepreneurship?
Well, I think in some areas there's been more of an effort than in others. For example, there's been a big effort at access to credit, and especially microcredit. But we know that microcredit is only one part of the story. It may be okay for women that are in the micro, on the micro entrepreneurship side, but it's not going to be enough for women who want to grow their business, who want to internationalize, for whom microcredit is going to be a bit too little, too late. Take the example of laws. In laws, there's been an effort at changing these laws. For example, the Interparliamentary Union, which is the body that gathers parliaments from all around the world, have made concerted efforts at changing these laws. But there are other areas where the efforts have been less. For example, on procedures, very often because we don't have the data. We don't have gender disaggregated data that will allow us to tackle those obstacles. There's not been enough done at the level of networks, and certainly we are not doing enough at the level of culture, norms, and traditions.
And you argue in your chapter that the international community needs to mainstream gender considerations in international trade policy. What would that look like?
Well, the International Trade Center has argued that the efforts at bringing women into the economy also have to look at trade policies, not necessarily only at trade support, development assistance, but also at the policies themselves. Obviously, this starts with getting and collecting gender disaggregated data. Very often, we all hear this argument that policies are the same for everybody, so policies as such are not discriminatory. And it may be so that they are not crafted with a desire to be discriminatory. But if the starting point is different, if the data shows, for example, that women are more likely to be smaller in size, women in business, than men in business, we know that women are going to be more sensitive to trade costs. So it is going to be very important to craft trade policies to address this particular element of trade costs. So I would say the first thing that trade policies need to do, or trade policymakers need to do, is collect gender disaggregated data that would help them understand how to craft these trade policies a little bit better. But then we can also go into the substance of the policies themselves. For example, policies that push for non-discrimination should also consider non-discrimination on the basis of gender. For example, policies on public procurement should also take into account the fact that today the bids are done in a certain way, and this is limiting the ability of women to participate in public tenders. So it's, again, not just looking at what flanking measures are necessary, but also looking at the hard core of trade policies, which is one of the reasons why the International Trade Center, under its She Trades initiative, has placed a very important focus on trade policies, which a number of countries around the world, including Canada, including the European Union, including Iceland, are eager to work with the International Trade Center to help address.
One quote in your chapter that really stood out to me was, quote, "Achieving gender equity is thus not only a worthwhile objective in its own right, but also smart economics," end quote. Would you mind explaining the economic logic behind that and why it might be appealing to a country that might be resistant towards liberalizing women's participation in the labor force?
Yeah, I think it is very important to position this fight for women's equals right to participate in the economy within an economic context. And for three main reasons, I would say, this is important to all nations around the world. One, because we know that countries that ensure equal participation of women in their economies grow more and they grow in a more inclusive way. So it is good for growth and it's for good quality growth. And frankly, I don't know any country in this world that is interested in foregoing growth and solid growth opportunities. Just to give some figures, because at the end of the day, we have to ground all of this in facts and figures. If we were to eliminate existing discriminations to the participation of women in the economy, we know that it would be like adding a new economy to the world of the size of the US and China combined together. This is what McKinsey Global Institute is telling us. Second reason why this is an economic discussion. We know that companies that bet on diversity, that embed more women into their workforce, that embed more women at the top of their management, are more productive, they are more competitive, they pay better wages. So it's also good, not just good for the economy, it's also good for the company. But three, we know that the spending pattern of women around the world is slightly different from that of men. Women spend a greater part of their revenue in their family and in their community, which means that they are likely to contribute to poverty eradication in a greater way than men. And again, this is not me saying it. This is what the World Bank, this is what the IMF is telling us. And this is why if we are all committed to eradicating extreme poverty under the United Nations global goals, and this we have undertaken by 2030, we have to care about putting more women in our economies because it's a faster route to end extreme poverty.
And I would imagine that there's a bit of a snowball effect there, where the more women that you have participating in the labor force, the easier it is for future generations of women to start participating in the labor force.
That's absolutely right. There is one thing, and this is what I put another chapter, culture, norms, traditions, role models. Obviously, we are lacking role models in many areas of our economy. I'm thinking, for example, about science and technology, where the participation of women is fewer and of girls into this education stream is smaller than that of boys and therefore than of men thereafter. If we manage to start seeing, if we see more girls studying STEM, science, technology, mathematics, engineering, and they become our role models for future generations, for the next generation of girls wanting to go into STEM, it would be a normal thing to do. So there is a big value, and you're absolutely right, in this idea of role models. And on this one, we can always, every one of us can help, because every one of us can help change culture, norms, and traditions.
In terms of actually mainstreaming gender considerations into international trade agreements, what are some current initiatives that are going on, and what else can be done to make sure that these considerations do become core parts of not only just regional trade agreements, but all trade agreements going forward?
Well, what we're trying to do in the International Trade Center is bring this debate also to the World Trade Organization, which at the end of the day is the house of global trade, which is where all nations in the world kind of sit together to discuss trade policies and trade practices that can be emulated. Our starting point in doing so is, again, the fact that all these WTO members have signed on to the United Nations Global Goals. Goal number 5, gender equality. Goal number 17, trade as a means to an end. Trade as a means to end extreme poverty. Putting goal 5, gender, with 17, trade, is what we are aiming at. We are doing this since the International Trade Center sits in Geneva, and it's a daughter organization of the World Trade Organization. We are supporting through our She Trades Initiative a dialogue in the World Trade Organization. On the 20th of June, there will be an event in Brussels co-hosted by the International Trade Center and the European Commissioner for Trade, Cecilia Malmström, precisely to start fleshing out an agenda that could also be useful for trade policymakers. The Director General of the World Trade Organization will be there. The Secretary General of UNCTAD will be there. A number of ministers, businesses, bankers, civil society from all across the world will be there to craft an idea of concrete suggestions for trade policymakers.
And lastly, the nature of trade is really changing, and the fact that, you know, there's a lot of bilateral, regional deals going on, trade deals going on right now, as opposed to the larger, more multinational initiatives. Will it be as easy in the future of trade, given these different changes in the way that people are trading, to make sure that these considerations are still taken into account when you're dealing with only a handful of countries as opposed to a larger, more broad community?
Well, I think there is one element in today's international trade that would be particularly favorable to the participation of women in international trade, and this is the fragmentation of production. The fact that today you don't have to produce an entire product or deliver an entire service. You could be producing parts of a product or delivering parts of a service. So it's more adapted for companies that are smaller in size. Second element that goes in favor of women's participation in international trade is also the digital economy. The fact that it doesn't matter where you are, it doesn't matter your size. What matters is your, let's say, intellectual input, your innovation, your ingenuity, your value added. And I am convinced, since I see this every day in my work, that this ingenuity, innovation, value added is also what many women in business have to offer around the world. So I think these two ingredients, fragmentation of production and the digital economy, are particularly adapted to seeing more women participate in international trade. But again, for this to happen, we have to remove these structural obstacles that are today impediments for women's participation in the economy, including in international trade. If we do, we know the big win is more growth, more quality growth. So frankly, again, the why seems to be quite clear to me. It's now on the how that we need to invest, because we know that the clock is ticking. The when is 2030.
Well, Ms. Gonzalez, thank you very much for joining me today on the podcast.
My pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Arantxa Gonzalez's chapter in the IRPP's new trade volume can be read on our website for free. It's been one of the most popular chapters in our book, so I definitely suggest giving it a read. I've provided a link to the chapter in the podcast description. Make sure to let us know if you have your own idea for a potential podcast topic or guest. You can reach us by tweeting at IRPP, writing on the IRPP's Facebook wall, or sending an email to policyoptions@irpp.org. You can also reach me on Twitter at Alex Shadid. If you like today's episode and want to hear more like it, just search Policy Options Podcast on SoundCloud, iTunes, or your favorite podcast app. Until next time, thanks for tuning in.